TikTok's parent company is beholden to the Chinese government. And so when people, when Americans stop and think about how do they feel about the power, the access, the capability, the control that TikTok has, they need to be thinking about it in terms of how do they feel about that same power, access, capability, control in the hands of TikTok's parent, in Chinese government, and ultimately in the Chinese intelligence services.
FBI Director Christopher Wray on NBC News. Wray and other government officials concerned about TikTok now have legislation backing them. Today, President Biden signed into law a bill that says TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance has up to a year to sell it to an American company or face a ban. The bill, which was part of the $95 billion foreign aid package, was passed with bipartisan support. But this is not the end of the story. TikTok says the legislation is unconstitutional and that it'll fight it in court. Joining us now to talk about that part of the story is Alan Z. Rosenstein, law professor at the University of Minnesota and a senior editor at Lawfare. He's also an advising attorney to the Justice Department on cybersecurity matters. Welcome.
Thank you. And I should just clarify, I'm no longer working for the Department of Justice. That's what I did before I became a law professor.
Okay, got it. Okay. But you have talked to them about cybersecurity matters. Have you talked to them about TikTok in particular?
No, I have not worked for the Department of Justice for several years now.
Okay. So let's talk about their main argument, TikTok's main argument. And they say forcing a sale or banning it entirely violates their First Amendment right to free speech, and it violates the free speech of the people who use it, who share videos, who share information between one another. Tell us more about that side of the argument.
Sure. So, whether TikTok itself has a First Amendment right is a little complicated, but there's no question that TikTok's users, particularly the, I think, 150 million Americans who use the service regularly, absolutely have a First Amendment interest, at the very least, in using TikTok services. And so if TikTok ends up being banned because it's unable to find a U.S. buyer or because ByteDance, its parent company, or the Chinese government don't allow a divestiture, that would definitely, at the very least, impact the First Amendment rights of TikTok's American users, and therefore the government have to have a very good reason to take that step.
And they say they do have a very good reason, and that is a national security reason. So what is the argument on that side?
There are two arguments. The first is that because TikTok collects, like all social media companies do, a massive amount of information about Americans, there's a national security risk to allowing, again, ByteDance and therefore, by extension, the Chinese government, access to that information. That's one concern. And the other concern is that because TikTok is really governed by this algorithm that recommends information to, recommends content to viewers, that would give, again, ByteDance and therefore, again, the Chinese government, the ability to push a particular position, to basically push Chinese propaganda by tweaking the algorithm. And that's, again, another national security threat, especially if the United States were to end up, for example, in a conflict with China over Taiwan or some other geopolitical crisis.
Okay, so when courts have looked at this issue, national security versus the First Amendment, where have they usually landed? On which side?
There's no one answer. The government can't just wave around the term national security and therefore do whatever it wants. The First Amendment, as people have noted, doesn't have a national security exception. On the other hand, courts are a little bit more, let's call it flexible, when there's a real national security issue at stake. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the First Amendment is not an absolute bar. It's a balancing between the interests of the government and the interests of the people whose First Amendment rights are being infringed on. And while, again, the national security doesn't form an exception to the First Amendment, it's definitely a very important interest. And there are several cases, including reasonably recently, in which the courts, including the Supreme Court, have permitted government action because of national security that they otherwise probably wouldn't have under the First Amendment.
Right. And so, but there's also been a case that has been cited in media accounts and elsewhere by a scholar such as yourself that prevents the governor from the government from banning foreign propaganda. And this is a case from 1965. and it's called Lamont versus Postmaster General. Would that case come up? Because this was a case in which the government was not allowed to ban communist propaganda being mailed to people.
That's right. And I think it wasn't just communist propaganda. I think it was specifically Chinese communist propaganda. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's a very relevant case. It would definitely come up. The question is, what does that case stand for? So I think it's unambiguous that that case means that the government can't ban a particular Chinese news source, a particular Chinese journal, right? It can't ban the People's Daily. But at the same time, that's not what this law does. This law does not ban Chinese propaganda. What it bans is foreign, in this case, Chinese ownership over a very broad communications platform in a way that would allow for the Chinese government to influence the viewing habits of 100 million Americans. And that's quite different than banning a specific piece of propaganda content or a specific outlet that is clearly controlled by, let's say, the Chinese government and is a mouthpiece. And so the question isn't, you know, is that case relevant, but how does that case that was about, you know, a newspaper 60 years ago, how does that map onto fundamentally a very different context of a mass social media platform?
And what I mean, I'm thinking of Rupert Murdoch as another example. So he is an Australian national who owns a lot of or owned a lot of U.S. media properties. And was he forced to get American citizenship before he could buy those properties?
That's right. And I don't know the details of specifically all his properties, but he became an American citizen, I believe, in part to avoid some of the restrictions on foreign ownership of broadcast companies. And I think this just gets to a broader point, which is that although this kind of divestment or ban is unprecedented because it's really in the context of social media, though I should correct myself, it's actually not fully unprecedented. Several years ago, the U.S. government forced Grindr, which was a dating service, to divest itself of also Chinese ownership because of concerns. The broader point is that the U.S. law has for over 100 years imposed foreign ownership restrictions on telecommunications companies. So this is not that unprecedented. Now, whether or not this particular restriction passes the First Amendment is a separate question. But I think it's important to situate this latest law in a broader context.
Right. And then TikTok also has Project Texas, which moves all of its data for U.S. users to Oracle, a U.S. company. Would that be enough to maybe sidestep this ban?
Well, so it wouldn't be enough in the sense of the law does not permit something like Project Texas in lieu of a divestment. But Project Texas remains very relevant and I think will be prominently discussed in the litigation because TikTok, I suspect, will argue that that was a better alternative or that was a workable alternative to a divestment or ban. I think one thing that Congress hasn't done such a great job of, and again, I think this will be an issue in litigation, is articulate exactly why Project Texas was insufficient. Now, Project Texas has its own flaws, its own issues. But I do think that it's a powerful argument for TikTok to say that there were alternatives that would have achieved the goal that the government is trying to achieve, but in a way that was lighter touch than divestment or ban.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Alan Rosenstein, law professor at the University of Minnesota and a senior editor at Lawfare. The Supreme Court today seemed deeply split along ideological and even gender lines as they heard an abortion case out of Idaho. Idaho has a law that bans nearly all abortions with a narrow exception for rape and incest and when the life of the mother is in danger. If a doctor performs an abortion outside that window in Idaho, they can lose their license and they face 5 years in prison. Well, the Biden administration argues that a 1986 federal law supersedes the Idaho law when it comes to hospitals treating patients who have an emergency with their pregnancy and need an abortion. The law says hospitals cannot turn away people who come to the ER. They must, quote, stabilize that patient.
If the woman is going to lose her reproductive organs, that's enough to trigger this duty on the part of the hospital to stabilize the patient. And the way to stabilize patients in these circumstances, all doctors agree.
That's liberal justice Elena Kagan. Conservative justice Samuel Alito was not convinced the federal law should override state law.
How can you impose restrictions on what Idaho can criminalize simply because hospitals in Idaho have chosen to participate in Medicare.
Joining us now is Mary Ziegler. She's a law professor at UC Davis and author of several books on abortion. Her latest is called Roe, The History of a National Obsession. Welcome back to Press Play, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
So back in 1986, Congress passed what's called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And that was basically to say to hospitals, look, if you take Medicare funding, you can't turn people away when they come to the emergency room. You can't say we can't treat you because you can't pay. So how is it that the Biden administration then said that this applies to abortion?
The Biden administration's position in the case has been that this statute, which people call EMTALA for short, actually creates a national standard of care. Essentially, it says you're not allowed to turn people away. You have an affirmative duty to provide stabilizing treatment. The administration argues that according to pretty much any obstetrician or gynecologist, that under certain circumstances, terminating a pregnancy is the stabilizing treatment that's required. The upshot of that is that the Biden administration is interpreting EMTALA to preempt or conflict or trump some of the state laws that disallow abortion under certain circumstances. And Idaho, of course, is pushing back.
And Idaho is saying what exactly?
Well, Idaho is saying a bunch of different things, which is why the oral argument, if anybody listened to the oral argument, it was actually a little confusing. Idaho at some point seemed to be saying, well, there is no conflict because all of the incidents that or types of scenarios where the Biden administration says an abortion should be permitted under EMTALA, it actually is under Idaho law. At other points, Idaho was saying EMTALA doesn't create a national standard of care. It just means that if a hospital already decides to provide a certain kind of treatment, it can't allocate that treatment differently based on ability to pay. Idaho even said that language in the statute, which uses the term unborn child at various points, means that Congress couldn't have intended to treat abortion as required stabilizing treatment because EMTALA, Idaho argued, actually views the unborn child or fetus as a patient too. So Idaho is kind of a grab bag of arguments that the justices were sorting through.
But it appears that the majority of justices were siding with Idaho. And tell us about some of their issues, their concerns, and what they said today when it came to this Idaho law.
So some of the justices raised questions about whether Congress had the power to attach these strings to Medicare funding based on Congress's spending authority. A lot of the conservative justices raised questions about whether a health exception under EMTALA would just be unworkably broad. So several of the justices suggested, for example, that it might cover mental health as well as physical health, which conservatives and abortion opponents have long argued, you know, that mental health is essentially elective abortion or abortion for any reason. That's been a longstanding talking point on the right. And we did see several justices, Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch, pick up on this thread that the unborn child language in the statute means that Congress couldn't have intended to create emergency access for abortion.
But on the other side, I heard Justice Sotomayor raise the issue of when does a doctor know that they are providing stabilizing care when it comes to a woman who presents with pregnancy complications? Like, if she's not at death's door in that moment, would the doctor then be penalized for providing an abortion, even if the prognosis is very poor and that the woman might, if she's sent home, I don't know, bleed to death or encounter some other serious health complication? How did the Idaho lawyer, the lawyer representing Idaho, how did he respond to that?
There was this sort of weird dichotomy between a lot of the liberal justices and a few moments, even Justice Barrett, sort of explaining what the world in Idaho actually was like for people experiencing pregnancy. And then I think Mr. Turner, who's representing Idaho, essentially saying, you know, that things were going pretty well in Idaho, right? That it wasn't, physicians had good faith discretion to decide when someone's life was at risk, and that there was really sort of nothing to see here. That was sort of the tenor of Mr. Turner's argument. And that was very striking to me, because you don't usually hear the justices deal with the real world implications of their decisions in that way, right? To actually confront what has happened since Dobbs. And you saw some of the justices, and again, even Justice Barrett at moments, you know, reacting to that. And even, you know, Justice Alito at various points, when he was making the suggestion that a fetus or unborn child would be treated as a person under the statute, General Prelogger responded, Elizabeth Prelogger's arguing for the Biden administration, that that would in some way treat a pregnant patient as a non-individual or non-person. And even Alito sort of said, well, no one's saying that. He was actually defensive about it. So this was a more emotional and kind of grounded in this kind of crisis we're seeing in states kind of argument, more than I'm accustomed to anyway.
And so would it come down to deferring to states' rights, if you will, that the conservative justices are reluctant to say that federal law trumps the state's decision when it comes to anything, including abortion?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, most likely, again, I think it was hard, even though I think you're right that Idaho seems likely to win the case. The justices were a little bit all over the place about what the rationale would be that they would adopt for Idaho to win. But most likely, whether that's a broad or a narrow win, the conclusion is essentially going to be that EMTALA isn't a tool the federal government can use. And that at least as far as EMTALA is concerned, it's just up to the states to do whatever they want. Obviously, that doesn't mean that there aren't other possible federal challenges you could bring, but you know, it would certainly raise a cautionary sort of note for abortion rights supporters anyway, because any federal question is ultimately going to land before the same Supreme Court.
Mary Ziegler, law professor at UC Davis and author of the book Roe, The History of a National Obsession. Mary, thank you.
Okay, yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the new law President Biden signed giving military aid to Ukraine and forcing TikTok to be sold, both examples of what my next guest calls the new Cold Wars the U.S. is in with Russia and China. David Sanger says multinational tech companies are also in the mix.
So suddenly you have Elon Musk playing Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor and maybe Secretary of State all wrapped into one.
David Sanger is here to talk about his new book, The New Cold Wars, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A little over a year ago, as Chinese President Xi Jinping left a state reception in Moscow, he paused in a doorway at the Kremlin, turned to Russian President Vladimir Putin, and said through an interpreter, quote, "There are changes happening, the likes of which we haven't seen for 100 years. Let's drive those changes together." Putin responded, "I agree." The two men shook hands and parted ways. A seemingly small moment of statecraft between the leaders of two big powers, but symbolic of what my next guest calls the new Cold Wars against the United States. Wars that flare up in hot zones like Ukraine and the South China Sea and maybe someday Taiwan. David Sanger is a Pulitzer Prize-winning White House and national security correspondent for The New York Times. He has spent years reporting out his latest book. It's called New Cold Wars: China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. David Sanger joins me now. Welcome back to Press Play, David.
Madeline, so great to be back with you.
Well, talk about that moment I just described. So this was in March of 2023, and it seems small and inconsequential, probably took about 20 seconds all told, but really an important one that illustrates the thesis of your book.
You know, that quote sits on a separate page just as you are opening the book. We chose it for a reason, because one of the themes running through new Cold Wars is that we are now seeing a partnership between Russia and China, not a full alliance, not an easy relationship, but a partnership that is exactly what Nixon and Kissinger were trying to prevent when the U.S. did the opening to China in the early 1970s. And this book is an effort to try to document both the failed assumptions we made at the time that Russia and China, each for their own reasons, would join up with the West on Western rules and come around to operating as one big global community. And then what happened and how you can explain today's events by the fact that the world went in a different direction, and that rather than have a coalescing around liberal democracies, what was supposed to be the end of history that was being discussed after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have had the creation of a new Cold War, or set of them, Cold Wars, that it's plural for a reason in the title, that are far more complex and I would argue far more dangerous than the one that we thought we knew in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Well, it involves more than just a big superpower in the form of the Soviet Union. Back then, China was agrarian, right? I mean, in the 70s, right. There it was not the technological powerhouse it is today.
The old Cold War was a fairly simple military confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. It was terrifying because both had nuclear weapons, but it was also predictable, Madeline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a hotline between the two because you could be assured that the right person would pick up the phone. We knew who was in command of their nuclear weapons. They knew who was in command of our nuclear weapons. We had a few crises that could have turned horribly wrong, notably the Cuban Missile Crisis. But in the new Cold Wars, you have none of that predictability. You've got two major players, each with somewhat different interests. You have a lot of states on the side who are either allying with one side or another. Iran, obviously, is a supplier to Russia for drones and other military equipment in the Ukraine war. You have countries that are hoping to play both sides. There's a chapter in the book called Don't Make Me Choose, which comes from a Singaporean ambassador fretting over the concern that her country and other nations were being made to choose camps. And increasingly, that's what's happening. You're seeing sort of the fall of a new Iron Curtain, some parts of which are around the border areas between Ukraine and Russia, the very disputed border areas now where the war continues to rage, but others in the Pacific as well. So this era that we thought was coming, the one in which Bill Clinton would go to Beijing University and say to students, the internet will set you free and undercut the Communist Party of China, or the days when George W. Bush and Putin were floating down the Neva River outside of St. Petersburg, talking about how Russia might join the European Union or eventually become a member of NATO. Those seem unimaginable to us today.
Yeah. Well, talk about that, because that was something that James Baker, back in the Reagan days, right, kind of promised the Russians that, oh, well, if you behave yourselves, not in those words, you might become a member of NATO. Did the Russians really believe that? Did they believe that the United States really wanted to admit Russia into NATO?
I don't know if they ever went that far, but there is certainly true that Russia and NATO had a joint office inside the NATO headquarters in Brussels. You could go into the NATO-Russia office and they talked about coordinating plans. There is no NATO-Russia office anymore. It was a victim of the attack and invasion of Crimea in 2014. There is now a NATO-Ukraine office in pretty much the same space.
But NATO was set up to counter Russia, right? I mean, that's the kind of purpose of it.
NATO was created to contain the Soviet Union. And you're about to see in Washington this July a 75th anniversary of NATO. And it's something between remarkable and ironic that on the 75th anniversary, NATO is coming together again on the question of how well it is doing at containing the Soviet Union's successor state. That's not where NATO thought it was going to be, Madeline. You know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the question was, what is NATO's purpose? And then you saw moments when NATO was operating out of area in the Balkans and so forth. But now you see it back to its core mission. The problem is that we don't know how Ukraine's going to turn out. And if it turns out that the Russians are victorious or seize a good part of it, or even get a good part of it in a negotiated settlement, this may not be the end of Russian adventurism. In fact, the argument that President Biden has made for continued support of Ukraine, especially during the congressional debate, has been that if victorious in Ukraine, Russia would not stop there.
Wow. All right. But I just want you to get at this idea that Russia did this because of NATO encroachment, invaded Ukraine because they feared that NATO would keep pushing further and further east, first with Ukraine, and then who knows who would be next. But that has been questioned as the motive, that Putin had all along thought that Ukraine belonged within Russia. How big was the NATO grudge?
The NATO grudge was big, but I'm not sure it was the motivation for Ukraine. Look, Putin was complaining about NATO's expansion as early as 2007 when he went to the Munich Security Conference, and the story of this is told in the book, and gave a speech that said, look, there are parts of Mother Russia as envisioned by Peter the Great, who is Putin's hero in this tale, that need to return to Russian territory. Now, Ukraine, of course, has never been a part of NATO. It may become one over time. It has been promised that one day it would. And I think you could argue that one of the reasons that Putin invaded was the fear that Ukraine was drifting to the West and would become a member of NATO. But certainly there were many warning after the collapse of the Soviet Union that bringing countries into NATO could provoke the Russians over the longer period of time. My argument against this is, if we actually believe that these were newly freed and democratic states, then they had to have the choice about which side they wanted to join here. And if they met the requirements of NATO membership and were willing to fulfill the responsibilities of NATO membership, it would have looked pretty strange for the United States and its allies to say, I'm sorry, you can't join. We think it may be too provocative.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the United States is now caught in a tough spot because it's looking more and more like a proxy war. The U.S. never wanted it to be a proxy war, but how can it not be viewed as such?
That's right, and it's hardly the only one. I'm less worried in many ways, Madeline, about the proxy war nature of this than I am about the message that would be taken away by others should Putin succeed. Nobody is watching what's happening in Ukraine more carefully than the Chinese. And they must be concluding out of this that if the United States is not willing to commit forces to fight for Ukraine, not a NATO member, they probably also wouldn't in the case of Taiwan. And so then the question comes, what are the other things you can do in the way of integrated deterrence to keep China from moving in on Taiwan? Some of them are technological. The U.S. is helping build undersea drones that could pop up in the Taiwan Strait and interfere with a Chinese invasion. But I spent a lot of time for this book traveling around the world, but particularly in Taiwan, mostly examining the question of, is the greatest deterrent to China the Silicon Shield? The fact that Taiwan Semiconductor, the company that is now the highest capitalized company in Asia, the greatest protection that Taiwan has, because China can no longer afford to destroy the largest producer of the world's most sophisticated chips than the United States could. And they are dependent on Taiwan Semiconductor, as we are. And I guess the conclusion I came to in the end of the day, Madeline, was that this is something of a diminishing shield over time as China learns the arts of chip making and as it learns how to evade the restrictions that the Biden administration has put on the export of the most advanced equipment for making those semiconductors. It will, over time, I think, erode Taiwan's edge.
So that was the motivation for the CHIPS Act, which I guess was something that the two previous administrations had tried to get through in some fashion and didn't, or didn't try hard enough. I don't know. But Joe Biden finally got that through, the CHIPS Act, which really was seen not in a favorable light by the Chinese. It really set back their semiconductor industry. How far back do you think it set it?
So if you ask people in the administration, they would tell you that the combination of the export controls that Biden has put on the shipment of advanced chips and that semiconductor equipment, most of which is not made in the U.S., it's made in the Netherlands, some in Japan, and the funding of companies to move facilities to the United States would give the U.S. an additional 10 years or so of a lead. But you made a really interesting point, which was the Obama administration thought about this but didn't act on it. The Trump administration actually began to move in that direction but never completed it. And Biden got it through, $52 billion for the semiconductor industry, billions more for research, for worker training, and so forth. It was a pure and simple industrial policy. Though nobody in the Biden administration wanted to use those words because that's a bit radioactive, right? It's not something we do. To my mind, what I argue in the book is we need a different way of thinking about what industries and what kind of manufacturing is critical to our national security. If I went to you, Madeline, and I said, we need 10 more aircraft carriers to compete with an expanding Chinese Navy, I suspect that you'd understand and Congress would probably say, yeah, that's something the government should fund. Now, I don't actually think we need 10 new aircraft carriers because they're largely sitting ducks to asymmetric weapons. But I would argue that we need 10 new semiconductor fabs that make the chips that go into modern fighter jets, that fuel artificial intelligence applications, that go into your iPhone, and that you don't want to be dependent on either China or an island that is only 100 miles off of China and quite vulnerable. And yet there is still the concept in Congress that this is a matter for private industry. This isn't national defense. And, you know, I think that's sort of got to change. The last aircraft carrier that the United States paid for was the Gerald R. Ford. It was built about a decade ago. It cost about $15 billion after all the cost overruns. That's about the price of one semiconductor fab. It may have now gone up to closer to 20. And so that's the size investment you need. And yet I think you'd have a lot easier time arguing for the outdated aircraft carrier than the modern semiconductor fab if you were debating in Congress today.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with David Sanger. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning White House and national security correspondent for The New York Times, and we're talking about his latest book. It's called New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. So you argue that the reason, one of the reasons why America didn't believe that there would be in another Cold War with Russia or and or China was modernity, the march of technology, the interconnectedness of the world, that everyone would need everyone else and that would democratize everybody, which I guess didn't turn out. But I guess I'm wondering, why not? Why isn't that a bulwark against all-out war with the United States or a proxy war with the United States when these economies are so interconnected?
Look, they are interconnected, just as Europe was deeply interconnected prior to World War I, just as the world was pretty interconnected in the 1930s. And there's always an assumption that countries in the end will make decisions in their best economic interest, and that that would overrun their old arguments over territory or ethnic hostilities or some kind of nationalistic motivation. Look, this was deeply embedded in what President Trump was saying as he ran for president the last time and when he was in office, which is, oh, yeah, I'll sign the greatest trade deal China ever saw, and that will solve the problems. Well, he didn't get his great trade deal. We'll set aside why that is. But there was also an assumption built in that everybody basically votes with their economic interests. And history simply does not support that argument, that nationalism, that territorial desires frequently come to the fore, even if it risks your economic interests. I mean, Putin knew there would be sanctions if he went to take all of Ukraine. He just didn't think that we'd stick with it because the U.S. hesitated for so long to sanction him, as did the Europeans, after he took Crimea in 2014. In fact, the following year, the Germans, under Chancellor Angela Merkel, signed the Nord Stream 2 agreement. And that would have created a pipeline, now suspended, that ran around Ukraine. So Ukraine got none of the benefits, financial benefits of it, and straight into Europe. And Merkel declared that Putin was a reliable supplier.
So it wasn't just the United States.
Oh,
I mean, everybody
not.
Had kind of rose-tinted glasses when it came to Putin, is what you're saying.
And, you know, to some degree still do, Madeline. I spent the past 3 months living in Berlin, working out of the Berlin Bureau of the Times, and just sort of soaking in what Europeans were saying about this fascinating moment in history. And what really struck me was that there was a very large part of the German populace that grew up in the concept that the best way to go deal with Putin is wrap Russia in economic integration with the rest of Europe. And many of them said to me, you know, the moment will pass here with Ukraine. We'll come to a negotiated solution. Maybe Putin will get some of the Russian-speaking territory. And then we can go back to the strategy of just trying to wrap them in an economic embrace. Meanwhile, many of the elites in the country were saying, though not publicly, we're in this new Cold War or new Cold Wars for 40 years or more, and that we need to build up a defense strategy that matches that, a defense strategy that you couldn't pay for with a mere 2% of a country's GDP, which is the current NATO standard, but will probably require 3 or 4% or maybe more, something that most European countries don't even want to think about, even after Ukraine.
But what is the worst case scenario when it comes to Russia and Europe? If, let's say, Russia does indeed conquer Ukraine, what next?
Well, the worst case scenario is that Putin goes back and spends 5 or 6 years rebuilding his military, that he learns the lessons from the many, many mistakes he made in going into Ukraine, and that he comes back by picking off a weak, smaller member of NATO to establish the precedent that NATO may not really come to the defense of a treaty ally if attacked.
Like a Baltic state, an Estonia, for example.
A Baltic state, Estonia, Lithuania. You've already heard former President Trump on the campaign trail.
Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia,
if a country didn't meet what Mr. Trump viewed as the minimum amount to pay, he would tell Putin he can do whatever the hell he wants.
No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills.
Now, even if that didn't come to pass, those words make other countries in NATO begin to think, no matter who gets elected, even if Trump does not, maybe the United States is not the reliable defender that we thought. Maybe we need a new strategy of defense. Maybe we need our own nuclear weapons.
But then after picking off a Baltic state, does he then go to Poland? Does he then go to Germany?
It all depends on whether he has along the way shattered the confidence that NATO is an alliance that lives up to Article 5. You know, so much of this is psychological and is based on establishing the confidence in people's minds that the alliance will hold together even for the smallest and most minor member. And that's increasingly hard to do in this world, you know? Countries got added to NATO without much discussion here in the United States because nobody in the United States had to go really fundamentally ask the question, would you put American lives on the line to save X country, the newest member of NATO? Now we've seen two new members join since the Ukraine invasion, Finland and Sweden. And Americans can find them on the map and might well be perfectly willing to go defend them. But there are other members of NATO that I suspect, when push came to shove, people would say, do we really want to go get involved in this fight? And that is not just if Donald Trump is elected. That may be no matter who is president. I mean, if you're Ukrainian and you've heard President Biden say, we are with you as long as it takes, and then heard him have to shift that because of Congress's hesitations to, we are with you as long as we can be. That's a big change.
And a big change is members of Congress really parroting a lot of the Russian talking points and seeming very friendly to Vladimir Putin.
Well, this is one of the remarkable holds that former President Trump has on parts of the Republican Party. Look, the Republican Party we knew as we were growing up, Madeline, was by and large an internationalist, pretty anti-communist, anti-Russia, prior to that anti-Soviet Union party. And the fact that this split has developed at all is a huge change in the party. By the way, it's not just the Republicans. There are Republicans who say, I don't want to be spending on Ukraine because I want to spend on the border. But on the progressive side of the Democratic Party, there is opposition to Biden's pretty unlimited support for Ukraine. People saying, look, we were supposed to have the peace dividend so we can pay for primary education, so that we can pay for women's health care. So all the different things that were going to come out of the peace dividend that never actually emerged.
Let's talk about the role of private industry, because now you have corporations that have, you know, a bottom line that's bigger than many countries. And you have Elon Musk, for example, deploying Starlink satellites over Ukraine. You have Google, Microsoft doing surveillance and data synthesization and also working in China. So where do they fit into this whole new world in which you describe as the new Cold Wars?
So, Madeline, there's a big part of this book that follows my last one from 5 years ago, which was called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. Because when I was writing that, you were seeing the emergence not only of tech companies that had levels of intelligence that American intelligence agencies can't get. You know, Microsoft can survey everything that's happening in its office networks around the world and in the United States. Of course, American intelligence agencies are prohibited from collecting inside the United States or collecting on Americans, except if they have some extraordinary warrants from the FISA court and so forth. There are stories in the opening of New Cold Wars about the role that Microsoft played in the early warning that Russia was getting ready to invade as they saw malware activated against Ukrainian government agencies, and a group of Microsoft engineers alerted their leadership, who immediately alerted Ann Neuberger at the White House, who was the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technologies. That then went to Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor. And it all fit into the map of when the Russians would invade. But we also saw Microsoft in a week working with Amazon World Systems move Ukraine and its government operations to the cloud, which was absolutely critical because everybody knew that the first thing that the Russians would put their missiles through would be the big servers that ran all the data for Ukraine, everything from power management to veterans affairs to paying pensions, right? And so it was absolutely critical that Ukraine go to the cloud. And as you suggested, the only way you can put your data in the cloud is if you can communicate with it. And since the Russians were taking down traditional satellite networks, it was actually Starlink that saved the day. And that was not in the U.S. plan.
So now, does the foreign policy establishment, do they have to clear a seat at the table for these private companies?
These private companies have a seat at the table, whether it's cleared or not. Look what happened for all the good and bad with Elon Musk during the war. So he saves Ukraine by putting these communications together. Quickly, the Ukrainian military starts using the Starlink satellites to target their weapons and attacks. And one night, they call Elon Musk and ask him to turn on Starlink for coverage around Crimea, Russian-occupied Crimea, so that they can target Russian ships that are in port or near port around Crimea. And Musk refuses. This is all played out in Walter Isaacson's wonderful biography of Musk. And he refuses because he believes that this could start a nuclear war, right? He had been told if Ukraine attacks Russia on Russian territory or around Ukraine or around Crimea, which the Russians claim to be their territory, that could be the beginning of nuclear war. So suddenly you have Elon Musk playing Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor and maybe Secretary of State all wrapped into one. And that didn't seem like an acceptable solution. So it prompted a debate, and now you're seeing the Pentagon build a secure version of Starlink that it will run, not Elon Musk.
Oh, boy. Okay. Meanwhile, you have, as Christopher Wray has warned, that Chinese hackers have pretty much weaseled their way into every sector of our society and are biding their time to deal a quote-unquote devastating blow to U.S. infrastructure. They have put chips in the water supply?
They have put malware in pipelines for the water supply, utilities, electric power. And this is the thing that most panics American officials, that I think most Americans are fundamentally unaware of. It's a program that the U.S. has called, or actually one of the companies that follows it, has called Volt Typhoon. And the Biden administration and administration officials think that they have gotten out and explained this to Americans. And I remember saying to one just a few weeks ago, after he described how there had been testimony in Congress on this from Christopher Wray and from other intelligence and law enforcement people, they think the American people sort of get what's going on here. I said, you know, I've never heard the President of the United States talk about this problem in public, even without the phrase Volt Typhoon, which I readily concede most Americans would think is either the name of a novel or a weather system. What is Volt Typhoon? It is an effort by China to put code inside American water supplies, utilities, electric utilities, other parts of critical infrastructure. And the mystery has been, why are they putting this malware there? They have not activated it. They haven't tried to turn off the water anywhere or turn off the electricity. And the best answer that American intelligence can come up with is that their intent here is to make it clear that if there was an invasion of Taiwan or even a slow squeeze of Taiwan by China, They want to be able to slow the American response and perhaps create enough chaos in American society that Americans would turn inward and worry about where they're getting their water and their electricity and their air conditioning from, rather than worrying about what's happening on some island 3,000 or 4,000 miles away. And it's a pretty brilliant strategy. And the administration believes that they have sufficiently warned Americans about this because they've gotten intelligence chiefs who normally say nothing to come out and talk about it a little bit in congressional testimony. My own belief is they haven't done anywhere near as enough. You've never heard the president of the United States describe this.
I would wager most people have never heard of this.
I think if you, I said to somebody fairly senior in the intelligence community a few weeks ago, if you stopped people walking down Connecticut Avenue in D.C., you know, the most attuned policy community in America, and ask them what is Volt Typhoon, they would probably think you were talking about either a novel or a weather system. So I don't think the U.S. is at all prepared for this. We don't know how much of this code has gotten been found and eradicated because we don't know how much code is there. And by the way, it's not just the Chinese who have done this. A number of years ago, the Russians started putting code in our infrastructure. And the U.S. responded, as a story that I wrote in the Times many years ago with my colleague Nicole Perlroth, by putting similar code in the Russian grid. So that is the nature of the new Cold Wars, and it's something we never saw in the old version.
Right. And something you argue, as you said earlier at the outset of this interview, is more dangerous. We all grew up thinking nuclear war was the most dangerous risk. But you're saying no.
It is still the most dangerous risk. I mean, obviously, an outright nuclear war would be the ultimate catastrophe. But there are steps far short of that. You know, we're not likely to have a direct nuclear exchange, fortunately, with China or Russia in the new Cold Wars any more than we were in the old, because mutually assured destruction applies. But it doesn't apply when it comes to interfering with one's cyber operations or interfering with one's utilities and so forth. And so countries are looking for gradations of ways to get at the soft underbelly of their opponents. And that's one of the things that makes figuring out the deterrence calculations of the new Cold Wars so much more complicated.
David Sanger, Pulitzer Prize-winning White House and national security correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new book, New Cold Wars, that's with an S, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. David, thank you so much. Thank you for your book, your reporting, and thank you for coming back on the show.
Great to be with you, Madeline, anytime.
Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here with recipes for a spring legume, the fava bean. Don't miss it. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
For many of us, when we think of fava beans, that's what we think of, that scene from Silence of the Lambs. But Evan Kleinman says favas are not creepy. They're fun and they're fresh at farmers markets right now. So she's going to tell us how to eat them. Evan hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
Hi. I love that bit so much.
Oh, my gosh. That part.
It's just the greatest.
You know he improvised.
Of course.
He had to have. Amazing. That's why he is Sir Anthony Hopkins. Okay, fava beans. They are not sir or madam. They're just plain old fava beans, but they're also known as broad beans. Tell us more about them.
So they've been cultivated for centuries in the Middle East and the Mediterranean. They're one of those foods that is eaten nearly every day in some cultures and almost never in others. So throughout the Mediterranean, Middle East, China, parts of South America, and into Ethiopia, the bean is embedded in the food cultures, with certain dishes and ways of serving featuring both the fresh and the dried bean, which have quite different characteristics. Today, we're going to talk about the fresh bean.
The fresh bean. Okay.
Yeah, We're going to talk about fresh beans. They're one of our most ancient plants. Scientists now believe that domestication of the crop may have begun as early as 8250 BCE.
Really? Oh my gosh, when we were just crawling around in the mud, there was fava beans.
It really is amazing. Well, we needed something even when we were crawling around in the mud to to give us nutrition, and they're kind of a little powerhouse.
They are, because they're legumes, and everyone's always telling us to eat more legumes. So describe what they taste like.
Yeah, they're one of those plants that fixes nitrogen in the soil. So often they're the first plant that you see start pushing through the soil in the spring, and they're often used as a rotation crop. So you want to think lima beans, but sort of much better. So they're less starchy than a lima bean. They have a better texture. The color is just much more beautiful. It's deeper green, so pretty. And the flavor is less kind of meh compared to lima beans, which I do love a lima bean, but fava beans have a kind of nuttier flavor.
And they're big, right? They're very meaty. That's how I think of them, as meaty beans.
Well, the thing about fava beans is how you're going to prepare them and how much prep you're going to have to do really centers around how young the plant is. So when the plant is younger, you can eat the whole pod and you don't have to double peel the beans that are nestled in that pod. As they get bigger, there is an outer layer on each individual little bean that some people really love and is a great source of fiber, but it does make the bean a little tougher and it gives it a more assertive flavor.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, aside from being paired with a nice Chianti, what are some serving suggestions you have?
Well, the thing that's great about them is they're just such a team player. Uh-huh. So if you manage to get really young ones, like now at the farmer's market, you can just grill the whole thing, the pods, and sort of just dress them as you would a salad and eat the whole thing. Once they're out of the pod, you can just saute them with other spring vegetables. They go really well with asparagus and peas and herbs like mint, dill, fennel. And they're really great made into dips. People like to make kind of a fresh hummusy thing with them. And the Turks, gosh, they have so many different recipes for them. On the website, I'm sharing a couple recipes from Uslu Morhan, a really wonderful Turkish chef. She has a recipe for both an olive oil salad preparation and a yogurt salad preparation. But for me, the queen of all fava bean dishes is bagali polo, the Persian dill-inflected rice dish that is studded with fava beans.
Can you just boil them and eat them that way? Maybe put some, you know, salt or lemon juice on them, but just eat them plain?
Yeah, they would kind of be like edamame then. Yeah, you don't need to soak them. They're fresh beans when they're young and fresh. Dried favas, in the wintertime, we could have a conversation about them.
But when they're fresh, you can just pop them out of the pod and eat them just like that?
Yeah, you can eat them raw too. I love them raw when they're really young. And even just sitting there and pushing them out of the pod, out of its little separate little coating, can be very meditative. And the Italian way of eating them in the spring is usually like that, accompanied with a young pecorino cheese.
And of course, a Chianti. Come on.
A fine Chianti.
All right. You have links to the recipes we've discussed up at KCRW.com. And a reminder that while you're there, you can RSVP for KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest. It's at KCRW.com/pie. And it is this Sunday, the 28th. So don't miss it. Evan Kleinman will be reigning supreme there. So you can go and see her do her thing.
And let me interject.
Yes.
And Ira Glass is coming.
Oh, fantastic.
He is one of our judges, and he's going to be on the demo stage with me. We're going to have fun.
That sounds like a blast. Sounds amazing. Okay. And before that, the day before, you can hear Evan's show, Good Food. It airs on Saturday mornings at 10. And what's on your show this week?
Well, we have our last pie segment of the season, all about vegan pies. And I talked to Dan Pashman about his new cookbook, Anything's Possible. I'm doing a live show with him on Thursday, May 2nd, the week after the pie contest, which should be really fun.
And is that something we can go to and watch live?
Yes, you can get tickets through Now Serving, the bookstore in Chinatown. Go onto their events page and you can click through and buy tickets.
Okay, so that's for Thursday, May 2nd. You and Dan Pashman. That should be really fun too.
Really fun.
You have all the fun.
Oh yeah, my life is just, you know, just a dream, Madeline.
All right, Evan, thank you and have fun at Pie Fest.
Thank you so much.
She does have all the fun. We have all the fun too. And the fun is over, I have to say, because the show is over. But it'll be back again on, well, on Thursday, tomorrow. So I'll see you then. More fun ahead. Stay with us on KCRW.